I'd done Brian's first low budget feature that was called Public Access, and I was just supposed to edit the film. And in the 11th hour, the composer dropped out, and I had been dabbling in music as a hobby, rescoring friends' student films and doing my first paying gigs, which were like Quickset Lock Company training videos and Amco parking. And so when our composer dropped out and I said, look, I can write the score to this, he was like, I don't know. It's like all you do is flowery music and you know, you've never done anything sinister or dark. And I go, no, I can. I really understand this character because it was a dark film, of course. And of course, the joke is after that, that's all I got hired for was dark films. Based upon his clout that he gained from that, he basically put me in his deal to The Usual Suspects as both the composer and the editor. And that wasn't really a very common thing then. Of course, it isn't now either, but it had never really been done before. And the producers were rather leery of, okay, so this guy hasn't edited a film in the last year and a half. He's never really done a score for a real movie. And so I remember going to meet these guys. They were European, and they'd flown into LA to meet me and basically look at my face across the table and sort of size me up, like, can you do this? And one of my not fondest memories, one of my most indelible memories on the film was driving home after I told him, oh, sure, I can do this, no problem, and just having a coronary attack. And it was, I was a lot of palpitations in anticipation of having to pull this off. Just by default, I naturally fall into the orchestral traditional scoring category because that's what turned me on my whole life. I was this, you know, weird kid, which all I listened to is film scores and classical music. Go to the symphonies when I was 15, I mean, to the dismay of all of my friends. But, and so I saw The Usual Suspects right away as being that kind of score that harkened the classic scores of yesterday, but also the film itself had a sort of 70s quality to it, like Serpico and all that. And we just wanted to do something that was against expectations as well. Well, all I knew is that I didn't want it to try to be hip for its own good. You know, a memory that both Brian and I share is when I presented the synthesized mock-up of this theme to the film to a couple of the executives after we had a rough cut screening. And they sat us down, this was at a picnic table, I just remember the setting, you know, outside the theater, and he says, you know, I was really expecting the score to be a little more hip than that, you know, and we both at the same time said, good, because that's not what it's going to be. It's going to be something different that you don't expect on a crime movie. Because the expectation was, gritty crime film, you know, some sort of band of the day or of the moment to do something that's percussive and rhythmic. But I felt the film was more elegant than that, you know. That was part of, actually, when the film was released, was part of my fear that people were going to think it was a Pulp Fiction sort of ripoff, because Usual Suspects and Pulp Fiction were shooting at the same time. We didn't even know what Pulp Fiction was, but the difference is Usual Suspects sat in a can for a year and was not released until after Pulp Fiction. And when I saw that poster of the lineup, of course, I've now since been proven wrong, but when I initially saw the lineup of the guys, I thought, oh my God, people are going to try to think this is that we're trying to be like, you know, a Pulp Fiction kind of film. And I wanted to have a poster of this, like, porthole, you know, and showing, you know, some hood, some figure like Kaiser Soze in the background to show that the film was actually had some elegance to it. But obviously I'm not a person that's a marketing genius. So, yeah, I found the theme actually by a piece of film that I'd seen the DP accidentally shoot. They were shooting on the docks, and he let the camera on the tripod kind of slide over, and he had all of his lights, which were these different colored lights, were reflecting on the water. And I saw that, and I'm like, wow, this would be a great title sequence. And so I initially looped it and to try to make a title sequence out of it, but it didn't last long enough. So I had him go back out to the docks and pan the water, you know, because they were shooting out there again. And he did, but it really wasn't as long as the title sequence could be. So then this is back in the days of optical, I sent it to the optical house, and I asked them to loop it twice. And so you can see that it repeats. But that gave me this idea of sort of repetitive ostinatos, like la 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 la, because it was shimmering in the water. And so I just laid these la 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 la's down and just started experimenting of kind of playing a piano melody over it. And it just sort of came to be really easily. And at that time, when you're early in your career, though, you don't have a lot of belief in yourself necessarily. So you come up with something and you immediately self-doubt yourself. And you're like, well, I like it, but is this just stupid? Is this shit? Or, you know, I don't know. I mean, but I played it for Brian and he loved it. It was fun to weave that into to different parts of the score where you wouldn't even expect that to be the theme. Like the, you know, one of the famous cues from the album is the taxi highs, the da-na-na-na-na-na. But that's really da-na-na-na-na-na. It's really the theme. And so is Verbal Kin's theme on the soprano saxophone. It's da-na-na-na or whatever it goes. And it's really a play in the theme because all these characters play into Kaiser Soze in somehow, some way, and they're all linked together. So I thought the theme should sort of weave through all these characters. I used to think that being the editor was a huge advantage to being the composer because no one knew the film more intimately than me, the editor. But it really is a double-edged sword, I have found, since going off and scoring a lot of films without being the editor. And I think it becomes a wash of what the advantages are versus the disadvantages. I mean, the advantages are I know the film intimately, the disadvantage is I have barely any time to write the score because I'm the editor, and there's a big overlap that happens between the editing and the scoring process. Normally, a composer would be hired, you know, at least a month before I ever even start writing the score. But because I know the film so well, it's the horses are out of the gate the moment I start writing, because I pretty much have latently kind of been thinking about what I'm going to do. But So when I'm on a film where I'm just a composer, I have all the time in the world. Well, not all the time in the world. Usually you're crunched, but I have more time to sit there and I can be a little more objective perhaps. Although I do have the ability to completely sever my experience having been the editor, and then I put on the composer's hat. It's just like directing a film and then coming back and editing it. You can really, after about a week or so, you have that objectivity to dump those shots that you spent all day on. The crane shots will go, and so I really completely compartmentalize the two jobs. Either way, I don't sit there when I'm editing the film and start thinking of music as I'm editing. It may be a subconscious thing, and as an editor, I may subliminally create pregnant spaces for a dramatic moment that score is going to be. And in that regard, I'm probably telling a story musically without even realizing it. But I think the best film editors, whether they can write music or not, have a musical sense. And because music is telling a story, and so is editing. And your best editors, actually, you'll see in the cut, an ebb and flow, peaks and valleys that a composer would cherish scoring. So they're both very related. Well, here's my point of view about songs, is that if they have something intrinsically to do with the story itself or the time period, then I think they are often something that you can put in a film that the score could never do. Having said that, any other use of songs, usually, in my opinion, is a mistake. It's really a titillation for the moment, for the film to do well, and no one's really thinking about the legacy of the film, because everyone knows in 10 years you watch the same movie, and that part that you watch with the song that was hip today is going to be laughable. And the example I always use is this movie called Silent Running, which was this movie about starring Bruce Dern, and it was in the I think the early 70s or sometime. It was an environmental movie about him wanting to save the forests of the planet Earth, so they put them in these domes in outer space. And so you see the ship flying through space, and all of a sudden you hear Joan Baez start singing. And it's laughable. And the whole film at that moment collapses now when you watch it. And that's the danger in using source music for what I call the quick fix right now. And it really depends on the philosophy behind the movie, the director. Does he want a legacy, or does he want just the maximum amount of dollars right now? You know. But then the flip argument is something like The Big Chill, or even for instance, an Apt Pupil. A film that no one ever saw, but there's this one sequence where we decided to use this German bar song instead of score because it did more for that scene in terms of irony than the score could ever do, and because it was already a vintage piece of music, it was timeless. So I guess to sum up how I feel about it, source music is great as long as it will maintain a timeless quality for the movie, you know. and can do something that the score could never do for the movie, you know. I think electronics are a legitimate section of the orchestra, you know. And Goldsmith certainly showed us how that can work. You know, I think at times later in his career, he might have gone a little overboard, or early when these sounds first came out, especially in the 80s, maybe it was a little bit, he's a little bit too excited about these sounds. But nevertheless, he was at least I think he was more of a pioneer in the scoring world by keeping those sounds in check with being a part of the orchestra or a color in the orchestra. But what I don't like is, it really depends on the budget. I mean, what are you going to do if you have no budget? You have to use them. But if you have a choice, a lot of the films I see where, you know, a lot of the drive is simply provided by the electronics. I think sometimes that's the easy way out because I also think it's a misconception on the part of executives and some new composers that to create a scene that's got adrenaline, is driving, you got to go the drum loop, and that's just not the case. It takes more work, but you can actually do it with the orchestra, and if you knock your head against the wall, you could try to do it in a new, interesting way. And to me, it's a bigger payoff. It sounds better. You know, unless it's some weird avant-garde movie, then of course it'd be more appropriate to use electronics. It just depends on the film. But I think more times than not, the electronics are a crutch. There's not a genre I like more than any other. It's just as long as I'm not stuck in one for any long period of time. I discovered a really quirky side to myself when I did, like, you know, Pumpkin or Eight-Legged Freaks and even Goodbye Lover, which is another film no one saw, but it was one of my favorite scores that I wrote because I really love having a tongue in the cheek with stuff. And I stumbled across that part of me, and that is really fun for me to do. I love doing that kind of music. But then, of course, I did three of those in a row. I'd want to do something serious again. So the grass is always greener no matter what film I'm doing, but I just like to be able to change genres. So I don't feel necessarily more comfortable in any one genre over another, except for maybe a totally electronic genre. That's probably my least comfortable. But in terms of, like, comedy versus dark, I will embrace them with equal vigor if I have been on a previous genre already. And that's why I just had a blast at the time of this interview just doing Fantastic Four, because it's the superhero thing, but it's also fun. It's got, you know, it's got the serious, you know, dramatic side for the drama, the suspense. But it's also, I could let my hair down and go a little overboard because it's just a popcorn film and it's got this sense of humor to it. So I didn't have that restriction I had on X-Men, where it's very serious, you know, and the weight of the world is on your shoulders. And if you just cross the line in the slightest bit, it's going to be too, it's not going to be serious enough for the film. And it's not like you can have a big fanfare, because the characters in X-Men don't really go save anyone per se. They're all victims, really. But you know, something like Fantastic Four, they're saving the world, and I can play the theme more and more. And so I like projects where I can let my hair down and just sort of not feel restricted. Growing up with basically the big three, which was John Williams, Jerry Goldsmith. I should actually reverse that. Jerry Goldsmith, John Williams, and even James Horner came onto the scene when I was still a kid, you know. And so it was really those three, plus once in a while I'd hear some score by some other guy and go, oh, he's cool too, you know, the Maurice Jarres of the world out there. And so I became, you know, I'm a fan of any one of the really the period of the, you know, the 70s, 80s, you know, really mainly the 70s was the heyday for me for, like, John Williams and Jerry Goldsmith. And then Horner came you know, got criticism for trying to be them a lot, but you know what? He also, at the same time, would come out with a brilliant score, like Brainstorm, which we could hear isms of Goldsmith and so forth. But I credit him for a lot of the original things in that score too, and especially like Land Before Time. It's awesome, you know. And so I was very inspired by a lot of his stuff, because I think, like all of us, he found his groove as well as the career went on and felt more comfortable in being in his skin. And then he became, now you hear a Horner score and it's a Horner score. It's not a Horner score trying to sound like John Williams. It's Horner. And he found himself as well. I think it's a really much more comfortable thing when you find yourself as a composer and start feeling that confidence to just do your thing and not worry about anybody else or trying to sound like something else and basically feeling comfortable in your own skin and losing that fear, then you start having that signature, which I think is a great thing to have. I don't mind if someone hears a score and goes, oh, that's a John Ottman score. I think that's cool because it's like, okay, I've defined a style for myself. Thank God, you know. I like to think I can change my style and have versatility. But at the end of the day, you know, an expert film score geek will know that's John Ottman doing that. And that's fine with me.